From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
I didn't expect the doctor to turn to me as he did and say, you have a malignancy. It's called multiple myeloma.
Today, Tom Brokaw talks about being diagnosed with cancer 2 years ago. He's now in remission. It's the subject of his new memoir. We'll also talk about Brokaw's broadcasting career, including anchoring NBC's Nightly News and his early years.
I dove very deep into a curriculum of sorority girls and drinking beer. And then I actually dropped out of school.
Also, we talk with cosmologist and astronomer Chris Impey about the future of space travel.
Arthur C. Clarke was famously asked when we would have our space elevators, and he said 50 years after people stopped laughing. And I think people are about to stop laughing.
And Justin Chang reviews Good Kill, the new film about drone warfare from the director of Gattaca. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Tom Brokaw, got some really bad news 2 years ago. He was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, a blood cancer that's treatable but incurable. How it's changed his life is the subject of his new memoir, A Lucky Life Interrupted. Terry spoke with Brokaw last Wednesday to talk about the cancer and about his career in journalism. Tom Brokaw joined NBC News in 1966 and was the White House correspondent during Watergate. From 1976 to 81, he co-anchored the Today Show. Brokaw stepped down as the anchor and managing editor of NBC Nightly News in 2005, after 21 years.
Tom Brokaw, welcome to Fresh Air. I just want to start by saying my understanding is you've said all you care to say for now about Brian Williams. True?
True.
Okay, so let's just move on. So toward the end of your book, you report that your blood count had returned to normal, which is great news. Where are you now, and what's the latest prognosis?
The latest prognosis is that I'm in remission, and we hope to keep it there. A friend of mine asked an interesting question. He said, so where do those little guys go when they go in remission? And I said, I really don't know the answer. I just know that they're not in my bloodstream, causing a lot of difficulty for me. The prognosis is that I'm going to be on what is called a chemo maintenance program for the rest of my life, although I really think that they may come up with a cure for this incurable cancer before I check out. They're making such progress that it's very, very encouraging. So I take a low-dosage chemo pill every day. I liken it to what a diabetic does, and I'm prepared to do that. I've talked to a number of people now who continue to lead very active lives, even though they're on drug maintenance. So, and that's where I am at the moment and expect to be for a number of more years, however many more I have.
You're so lucky in the respect that doctors initially diagnosed your problem as back pain. You were actually getting fractures as a result of the multiple myeloma, but the doctors didn't see that on the x-rays. They didn't diagnose it that way. So when you got the diagnosis, were you shocked? Were you not expecting anything as profound as that?
I was certainly not expecting a diagnosis of a malignancy, a cancer. I thought, having just been in Africa, that I may have had a parasite of some kind, or there might have been something going on in my lower spine that the conventional x-rays did not pick up. I didn't expect the doctor to turn to me as he did and say, you have a malignancy. It's called multiple myeloma. You know people who have died from it. Geraldine Ferraro, the first woman to run for vice president. Frank Reynolds, the ABC anchorman. That was all in one pass. And I think we all wonder how we would react to that kind of news. I was kind of in two parts. I was a journalist on the outside looking in on Tom Brokaw, the person, and I was reasonably astonished that I was not shocked. I was not in a panic. I was very cool and calm. I wanted to know more. I immediately thought not about me, but about my family.
When you got the diagnosis, you were away from home. You weren't going to be returning home for another couple of days. So you had time to figure out how you wanted to break the news to your wife, Meredith. You knew you didn't want to do it by phone. So having 2 days to prepare for telling her, Did you rehearse, like, different ways that you could go about telling her?
I did. I rehearsed what I was going to say to her and the setting, because it was obviously going to be a profound change in our lives. I went through some more tests, and very late that day, I flew to Montana, arrived at midnight in a small town called Livingston. My wife picked me up there with my dog, and it's a torturous road to the ranch, so I didn't want to tell her on that road. And we got to the house, and we went upstairs, and I went down and fixed myself a big drink, sat on the edge of the bed, and said, "There's something I haven't told you. I was diagnosed with cancer. It's called multiple myeloma." And her eyes widened. She stared at me, as she later said, in disbelief. I said, "I don't know how this is going to turn out, but they assure me that they think that they can beat it, and it's going to change our lives." I tried to be as rational as possible about it. She asked me a couple of questions that I couldn't answer because I didn't know the answers yet. And as I say in the book, we have, at that point, had been married 51 years, and we had a shared relationship based in part on our Midwestern sensibilities and the great emotional attachment we have to each other. And we fell asleep in each other's arms to face this new world.
Because multiple myeloma invades the bone marrow, or assume this is why, you've had to deal with fractures caused by the disease. And that's brought with it a lot of pain. You'd experienced a lot of pain in the past. You'd been in a serious helicopter crash. You'd had a broken ankle, foot, finger. Compare that kind of pain with the pain of the effects of multiple myeloma.
Well, the multiple myeloma pain was much more excruciating, and it was paralyzing in a way. There were times when I simply couldn't get out of bed. Meredith was quite wonderful about helping me relieve myself in the middle of the night with hospital vessels that they would send over. My son-in-law came over and spent the night, New York son-in-law, to help Meredith getting me out of bed. So I had never been through anything like that. The other episodes that I'd gone through with a broken ankle, broken feet, broken finger, they also, all of them had a sell-by date. I knew when they were going to be fixed. With cancer, you know, there's no date on the calendar that says it'll end here at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And the uncertainty of that becomes something that you have to cope with as well. But the pain is the big issue. And if I can, I'll do a quick public service announcement for people my age, especially men. If you get a back pain and from 60 on, because you're a golfer or a tennis player or an active hiker, get a blood test. Because what often happens, and I've talked to two or three physicians who went through this, got a back pain because they were golfers and tennis players. They thought it was just another ordinary back pain. They went to an orthopedist, in one case to a chiropractor, to relieve what they thought was a conventional malady in their back. Well, then they ended up getting a blood test, and all of them had multiple myeloma. And so it's important that we're aware that there are other ways of diagnosing back pain than just looking at an x-ray from the middle of your back on up.
You write in your memoir that you think about mortality in ways that you didn't before the diagnosis. What's the difference in how you think about it now?
Well, I turned 73 before the diagnosis, and I do remember thinking, oh, I'm 73, so what? I'm going to be okay. My mother lived to be 92. I'm going to just keep on charging. I went immediately after that birthday down to South America to bike with friends across Chile and Argentina. I was a very active life. Never occurred to me that I was in the mortality zone, even though I knew intellectually and statistically that that was the case. White males now live to be about 76 years old, statistically, and I thought, I'll just blow through all of that. When this set in, I don't think it changed me profoundly. I just became more conscious of the fact that the days are more numbered now. As I say in the book, there are no long-term leases when you turn 73, 74, and now 75. And I'm looking more carefully at people at the end stage, how they died, what they were like at the end, how they handled it. Our daughter Jennifer is also, one of her great interests is is end of life, how families deal with it. And she really is very insistent that all families need to sit down and have a tough conversation. Who's going to be the caregiver? What are the circumstances about DNR, do not resuscitate? What do you say to the medical team if a member of the family goes in and seems not able to recover easily? And she says this will reduce the emotional turmoil a great deal if you talk about that in advance, and we have. So I think that she knows and my wife knows and the other members of the family know kind of where I am with that. But again, I don't expect to hit that cliff anytime in the next couple of years. If I can get through this, I do hope with the conditioning I have in the rest of my body and the ability to have that I have to get the help that I need, then I'll go on into my 80s.
The kinds of decisions that you've just spoken of are very personal decisions, but would you be willing to share any of your directives with us? Or if that's too personal, which it probably is, that's fine.
Yeah,
well,
I'll do that in a way that it might be helpful to everyone. When Jennifer first got interested in this, we were invited to do a TED Talk in Stanford, and it was a shorter TED Talk. We only had like 12 minutes. And so she began by saying, you have an advanced care directive, Dad? And I said, yeah. She said, where is it? And I said, I don't know. She said, well, let's begin with that. You got to find it. And who did it? And I said, a lawyer did it. That's a bad idea, Dad. You know, we needed the family to be involved in this. So she walked me through all of these things. And she said, what does quality of life mean to you? I said, well, you know, I don't like the idea of being confined to a wheelchair. But what if you're confined to a wheelchair and you can't walk, but you can do everything else and you have grandchildren that you can interact with? Wouldn't that be acceptable? I said, you know, I hadn't thought about that, but of course it would be. I could continue to write. What I don't want to be is hooked up to some kind of a system that's just artificially keeping me alive.
So just one more question related to this. Are you afraid of death? Are you afraid of suffering in the period before death?
I'm not sure that I would use the phrase afraid. I think that we had enough discussion in our family that we would try desperately to avoid any kind of undue suffering. My mother lived to be 92, and she did very well until the last year of her life, and then she was bedbound, in effect. And at one point, she'd had a knee replacement, and it came apart. And the doctor immediately said, well, we have to get her back to the hospital and repair that. And my daughter stepped between my mother and the doctor and said, no way. She's staying right where she is. You just splint that, and she's going to stay in this bed. If you take her to the hospital, she'll be gone in 20 minutes because she made it very clear she didn't want to go back. And in fact, with mother then housebound and confined to her bed, everybody could go by and say in a sweet and loving way goodbye to her over the course of the next 9 months. And that seemed to me to be a kind of a model for what families need to know. But you need somebody who, like Jennifer, could intervene or have a very strong set of instructions.
Tom Brokaw speaking with Terry last Wednesday. Brokaw's new memoir about his cancer diagnosis is called A Lucky Life Interrupted. Brokaw stepped down as the anchor and managing editor of NBC Nightly News in 2005 after 21 years. He joined NBC News in 1966.
When you started as a news reporter in Omaha, you didn't even own a TV. You went to, a pizza place or a bar so that there'd right. be a TV where you could actually watch yourself
right.
do your reports. Was it for financial reasons that you didn't own a TV, or did you just not care about television?
No, I cared about it, but Meredith and I got married in the summer of 1962 in August of that year. Her very generous parents, her father was a physician, bought us the least expensive new car on Main Street in Yankton, South Dakota. It was a Chevy 2, bare bones, no air conditioning, no radio, but it was great transportation. My dad, who was a working class guy, gave me like $400 or $500 in cash as a wedding present. We needed all of that to rent our first apartment, and it was a furnished apartment, and it was quite dreadful, quite honestly. But we didn't have enough money left over to buy a television set. So I would do these reports for the station where I was working, and then we would shoot down at 10 o'clock at night to this wonderful little Italian pizza place and watch. And the bartender, who was kind of Marty-like, remember the film Marty?
Yes.
And he would say
Ernest
to
Borgnine.
Us... Yeah, Ernest Borgnine, and he would look at us and he would say, "You're on television. Why are you here?" Well, we said, "I don't have a television set, so we have to watch it in here." And Ross Minotti was his name, and he said, "I won one last week in a church drawing. I don't need it. I'll bring it in, and you come back tomorrow night." It was a little turquoise 13-inch black and white television set, and then that led to us becoming very close friends with this extended family of Italian Americans in Omaha. So it was one more example of Brokaw's lucky life. I got a television set and a whole family of great new friends out of all of that.
And probably some good food. Yeah. So where was the first place that you anchored a newscast?
The first big break for me came when I was I'd kind of gone off the rails. I went off the University of Iowa as a whiz kid with all the promise. I'd been an athlete and an honor student and president of the class. I went down to the University of Iowa and dove very deep into a curriculum of sorority girls and drinking beer. And I didn't flunk out, but I certainly didn't distinguish myself. I retreated to South Dakota, continued my errant ways, and then I actually dropped out of school with the encouragement of a wise head of the political science department saying, "Get it out of your system. Come back when you're ready to do something for us." And I got a job in Sioux City, Iowa, $75 a week. Monday through Friday, I was the booth announcer announcing the station breaks. So the 10 o'clock news, I did the weather. And on Saturday nights, I did the news. And I began to think, I may be able to do this to make a living. So I went back to school and restored my reputation and restored my relationship with Meredith and got my degree and went to Omaha, where I did the morning news, 3 broadcasts every morning, inserts into the Today Show and the noon news and the Saturday night news. So it was a crash course, but I was very grateful for the opportunity to be able to do that, and it helped me a lot.
What necessitated you having to restore your relationship with Meredith, who later became your wife? Was it the beer?
Well, I really thought I was kind of getting away with it. One of my friends said, "You just rode that charm pony, Tom, across the landscape." And Meredith wrote me a very, very tough letter. We had been very close friends for a long time, and we were beginning to see each other just a little bit. You have to understand that she was the most sought-after girl in South Dakota. She was Miss South Dakota. She was an honor student. She was had this wonderful reputation for being both friendly and utterly in control of her life. So she wrote this letter to me saying, "I don't want you to call. I don't want you to show up. I don't want to see you again because I don't think you're going anywhere with your life, and it's terribly disappointing. Your parents don't know what to make of it, and all of your friends are disappointed as well. So please, Tom, no more." That was a huge wake-up call for me, and I went to another friend who was one of our best students as well, and I had stayed in touch with all of these, and he said, "She's right." So I thought, maybe I better change my ways, and I did. And she came to me later and said, "Look, I went too far. That was wrong." And I said, "No, I really had it coming." We had a cup of coffee, and a year and a half later, we got married. And it really was one of the great pieces of good fortune I've ever had, probably the greatest.
You became the sole anchor of the NBC Nightly News in 1983. What did being an anchor mean then?
I hope that it means the same thing today, is that internally you're the captain of the team. You're the one who the others look to, and you kind of help set the pace for what kind of a news division you have, what's important that you should have on the air, and how you do it. I always had the reputation, however, of being not just the anchor, but someone who listened as well to my colleagues, and was not afraid during the 2:30 editorial rundown meeting to have a vigorous exchange about what was important and what we should be covering that day. And then on the air, Monday through Friday, doing the news, it's always kind of undefinable for me. You convey something that the public either trusts or it does not trust. And it has to do with the content and how you handle the news, but it also just has something to do with your persona. The real test of an anchor is when there is a very big event and the unexpected one. 9/11 is the quintessential example of that. And that day, it took everything that I knew as an anchor, as a citizen, as a father, as a husband, to get through it. And I said later, I was so grateful to be the age that I was. Now, at the same time, my colleagues and competitors, Dan and Peter, were also in their chairs doing a superb job of covering it. That's when the anchor job really is crystallized, I think, in the eyes of the public and for those of us who do that kind of work.
Well, let me ask you about 9/11. As the story was breaking, you left home and went to the Today Show with Matt Lauer and Katie Couric.
Right.
And helped describe what was happening and break the news as you were able to. I'm sure part of your instincts were to stay at home, assuming that you had some family at home at the time. Perhaps your wife was there. I mean,
no, that's not true. What happened is that my wife was in Montana.
Oh.
She had arranged for my first yoga lesson. I was just wrapping up when I got the call. And when I heard a plane had hit the World Trade Center, at that point, everybody thought that it was some kind of an accident. But I knew I had to get there as quickly as possible. On the way there, I heard a very good radio reporter, Art Athens, say that he was in Washington Square Park, saw the second plane hit the tower, and I knew that the equation had changed. Called Meredith in Montana, said, I don't know when we'll be able to talk again, but you better turn on the television set. Went right to the Today Show, sat down with Katie and with Matt, and the first thing that we all agreed on was that don't speculate, just report what we know, because we didn't know a lot. We didn't know where it was coming from, who was responsible, how many people were still left in those towers. And then gradually, the responsibility for leading the coverage evolved to me. And after the second tower went down, I thought, I really have to prepare this country in a way for what we're in for. So I looked into the camera and said, this will change us.
Well, didn't you also say we're at war?
I did. Yeah. Right after I said this will change us, I looked in the camera and said, we're at war here. Now, there was some kind of a guy in one of the Ivy League schools who has made an issue of saying Brokaw didn't have the authority to declare war, and it's really a constitutional authority. Well, it's a gross misunderstanding of what the role of a journalist is as well.
Did you have any second thoughts about having said that?
No, I didn't, because I thought that we needed to be coming to grips with reality. And it was pretty clear that we were at war at that point. I thought that the country needed to be prepared for the next phase of all that. And I felt that I had been at it long enough and covered enough big stories and a lot of big changes in America. And this may be more self-centered than I realized, that I had a connection with the audience in which I could say that. And I thought that we all needed to hear the new reality.
So I'm going to ask this next question as someone who's been known to have an occasional stammer that I have to deal with on the air.
Yep.
You have a kind of slur in your speech sometimes?
Yeah, I have an L issue. By and large, it's been, over the years, it's been diminished a lot. I was unaware of it until I left South Dakota. And then I go back and listen to other people in South Dakota, and it's not uncommon. In our family, we had chronic hearing loss. And I really think that it came out of that, that I didn't hear it the right way at the right time. And I also grew up in working-class neighborhoods where we didn't have speech therapists. It didn't really come up until I left South Dakota. And I had a wonderful speech coach in Omaha who kind of got me started in the right direction. And I've worked on it over the years. But when I get tired is when it shows up most of all.
How did you know when it was time to retire from the anchor desk?
I don't think that there was one big nirvana moment. What I did know was that I have so many interests in life, and the seasons of news ratings and being an anchorman got in the way of some of that. I'd been at it more than 20 years at that point. I'd gone to all the big stories of the 80s, which is one of the most fertile times in American journalism around the world and here as well. And so I've always thought that life and my professional life should have seasons. And I was now in a season in which I thought it was time to go on and do something else besides be there every night at 6:30 in the chair, whether there was something important happening or not. And because I had the advantage of being a younger man coming up, and John Chancellor and David Brinkley before me, They stepped aside at some point. I had my opportunity. I thought it was the turn of a new generation. I was going to stay active, and that was part of the deal, as I have. So, but I did know that it was time to just step away from the everyday stuff. I've stayed very active. I've done a number of documentaries on big stories. I'm still available to be there if they need me. I've written several books since that time.
Tom Brokaw, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tom Brokaw spoke with Terry last Wednesday. His new memoir about how his diagnosis of multiple myeloma has changed his life is called A Lucky Life Interrupted. Writer-director Andrew Nichols' films, Gattaca and In Time, were science fiction thrillers set in a dystopian future. His new drama, Good Kill, starring Ethan Hawke and January Jones, is rooted in today's reality of drone strikes and America's war on terror. Justin Chang has this review.
Drones aren't going anywhere. In fact, they're going everywhere. These are the words of a U.S. military commander played by Bruce Greenwood, and they sum up both the relevance and the heavy-handedness of Good Kill. The film, written and directed by Andrew Nichol, unfolds in a present-day America where state-of-the-art drone technology has made killing one's enemies as easy as pushing a button. Ethan Hawke plays Major Thomas Egan, an ace Air Force pilot who has served 6 tours of duty overseas. Now he spends his days at an airbase just outside Las Vegas, blowing up suspected Al-Qaeda targets from 7,000 miles away. The audience is made complicit with Egan, observing the horrors of war from a disquieting remove, as his remote-controlled plane soars over vast, dry stretches of Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen. We see everything that Egan sees as he trains his crosshairs on unsuspecting Taliban officials. Sometimes children wander innocently into the blast radius, mere seconds before the rocket hits, sending Egan and the audience into a momentary panic. When the CIA gets involved and starts doing away with safeguards against collateral damage, Egan's work begins to destroy him from within. He drinks heavily and grows increasingly distant from his children and his wife, who's played by January Jones as a sort of modern-day version of Betty Draper. Hawke is worlds away from the boisterous motor mouths he played in Boyhood and Before Midnight. His Egan is a brooding, deeply damaged individual, and we sense that what he's suffering from isn't merely guilt, but deprivation. He misses the thrill of actual combat, as he explains over a beer at a bar to his younger co-pilot, played by Zoe Kravitz.
How bad do you miss it? Flying.
I miss the fear. You're up in the sky. Something can happen. There's a risk, you know. I mean, try landing in a carrier at night. In rough seas, the deck's pitching 30 feet, low fuel. We've got no skin in the game. I feel like a coward every day. Taking pot shots from half a world away in an air-conditioned cubicle. They get lucky they shoot my plane down. I'm not even in it. All you gotta do is pull another one out of the box. Worst thing that could happen to me is carpal tunnel, or I spill coffee in my lab. The most dangerous thing I do is drive home on the freeway.
Hawke's Egan comes off as a genuinely troubled soul, rather than a mouthpiece for a set of ideas, which is more than can be said for most of the other characters in Good Kill. The intelligence and moral seriousness of Nichols' filmmaking are undeniable, yet they're too often undermined by his determination to ensure that nothing gets past us, that we don't miss the implications of his story. Not content to be merely thought-provoking, the movie insists on doing too much of our thinking for us. In that respect, Good Kill would make an interesting double bill with the recent American Sniper, another movie about the tragic toll of war on the home front and the difficulty of telling friend from foe on foreign soil. Yet Clint Eastwood's film became a political lightning rod in no small part because of its troubling ambiguity. As thoughtful as it is, Good Kill is a tidier, preachier piece of work. A harder movie to argue with, perhaps, but an easier one to shrug off. By the end, I felt that Andrew Nichol had made a nearly airtight case against drone warfare, and I don't mean that entirely as a compliment. Good Kill too often feels more like a series of talking points than a fully developed drama. It's a movie that hits every one of its ideological targets, but still winds up missing the mark.
Justin Chang is chief film critic at Variety. He reviewed Good Kill, written and directed by Andrew Niccol. Our future in outer space is the subject of the new book, titled Beyond, by our next guest, Chris Impey. His book examines the past, present, and future of space travel and imagines what it would be like to establish a colony in space. As part of the Dalai Lama's program to bring scientific teachings into Tibetan monasteries, Chris Impey has made several trips to India to teach science to Tibetan monks in exile. Impey also has received a grant from NASA to write a history of U.S. space science and astronomy missions. His own research has been supported by $18 million in grants from NASA and the National Science Foundation. Impey is a distinguished professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona. He spoke with Terry last Monday.
Chris Impey, welcome to Fresh Air. So if we had not cut back on funding for the space program, what might we have accomplished by now?
Well, I think we might actually be living on the moon and Mars. Maybe not many of us, but we might have our first bases there. We'd have robust commercial space activity or people routinely in orbit. America wouldn't have had a hiatus of 4 years and counting when we couldn't get astronauts into space. It would be probably quite different.
So what's left of our space program?
It's actually still pretty good. So I think the perception of NASA and the doldrums and that we're in a bad space in our activity is a little exaggerated. NASA's budget isn't growing, but it's also not declining. So they're investing in new technologies. We're going to get a new heavy launch capability in a couple of years. The space station is active and doing scientific experiments. We're not launching satellites. There's a heavy entourage of spacecraft going through the solar system and exploring there. It's not quite as bad as some people make out.
And how bad is it?
Well, it's bad because this flatline budget doesn't allow you to do adventurous, creative things. It really limits you. NASA can only do one big, clever thing every decade or so. And that's kind of tough because there's five or six or seven big, clever ideas on the table, things we'd like to do.
There's a new chapter in the space race, and that is that China has entered. And China is buying up a lot of resources on Earth, like water and mineral rights in Africa. So what is it looking to do on the moon?
Well, they have a multi-pronged space program. And the contrast, of course, is that they've grown their space activity at the rate of their economy, which has been 10% a year for a decade and maybe slimming down a bit, but that's compared to our flatline budget for NASA. So they've got a doubling of their activity in less than a decade. They're looking to build their own space station, and it might be up there at a time when the International Space Station is deorbited and burned up in the atmosphere. They're looking to go to the moon. They're looking to have a Mars rover. And they're actually, unlike one of the stereotypes that they're just sort of copying our technology, they're actually innovating. And they have very young engineers in their space program, very keen, very well-trained, very ambitious.
If we, really stepped up the space program now and reinvigorated it with a supply of money, are there new innovations that have already been made that we could apply to space travel?
I think the innovations that we haven't seen yet are going to come in the small scale. Humans in space, it attracts our attention, it engages us. But, people are tricky in space. They're very fragile. They need to be fed and clothed, and they get bored and they get lonely. And protecting them costs a lot of money and takes a lot of resources. The miniaturization of space travel, we really haven't seen a lot of, but it's happening very fast. Particularly, there are things called CubeSats that are Rubik's Cube-type miniaturized satellites, where the cost of building a little package and putting it in a 10-centimeter cube is maybe $50,000 or $100,000. So universities or even student groups get together, and they bundle these and then launch them together. And also, we're putting what amounts to cell phone technology in space, the sort of cameras and sensors that are routine in our cell phones. You can put those in Earth orbit and do Earth-looking stuff or eventually outward-looking stuff. So these small packages that are much, much cheaper to launch than a person are really going to revolutionize some of the things that happen in space.
So these small packages, as you put it, are launched within rockets?
They're launched within rockets, but they're individual. The individual payloads are tiny, and you can just bundle a lot of them together and into a conventional rocket, or maybe use a small rocket. And so, for instance, last year, I think 140 CubeSats were launched, and that was more than in all the previous years, and the number is sort of doubling every year. So this is a real growth industry. And one part of it is it getting away from the NASA model. This is maybe one area where NASA has, you know, taken a particular tack, and which is NASA's really good at these big, complex, billion-dollar missions, the Hubble Space Telescope, Cassini, the Mars rovers. But they're big, they're expensive, they take a decade, they're huge commitments. And NASA's not really gone in this sort of quick, cheap, fast, and small route. And I think the private sector is doing that more vigorously than NASA is.
So what are some of the information or whatever that we're getting from these small packages that are being launched in space?
Well, one interesting example using the sort of cell phone technologies and cameras that are really not much better than on your cell phone is if you throw hundreds and hundreds of these little cell phone satellites into orbit, you just tolerate the fact that some of them will break or be destroyed or fall to the ground. And you have enough of them in orbit that they're planning to have a network that will be able to take a picture of every place on the Earth's surface literally every day or so. Maybe not with the resolution of the best GPS, so like a meter resolution, but that ability to monitor the Earth every day or so, everywhere, there's never been that capability. So it's a brand new capability enabled by these sort of cheap, small technologies.
You write about the possibility, perhaps a far-fetched possibility, of there eventually being a space elevator to get around the amount of fuel that you need to launch a rocket where you're basically sitting on an explosion all the time. So what's the vision for the space elevator?
A space elevator is, of course, a cool idea out of science fiction. And Arthur C. Clarke was famously asked when we would have our space elevators. And he said 50 years after people stopped laughing. And I think people are about to stop laughing. The idea is basically you string a cable up into space to the point where it's suspended, like in an Indian rope trick, by the spinning force of the Earth up to a geostationary point, the place where a satellite would be stationary above your head orbiting the Earth. That's a huge cable. That's a 100,000-kilometer cable into space. And so can you find a material strong enough to make a cable that long suspended against gravity? And on the Earth, you can't. So an Earth-based space elevator is not possible with our current materials. But a moon elevator, where the gravity is 1/6, actually could be done with current technology.
How do you even create a cable that long?
You build it sort of in stages. I mean, just as you would span a chasm sort of by sending a thread across and then turning it into a rope and then a cable and then braiding it into a big thing, you sort of do the same thing. You'll suspend a very gossamer thin cable up as far as you can and then gradually build it into a more robust cable where it's handling its weight as it gets constructed. It's an incredible construction project, but I've met engineers, some at NASA, some elsewhere. They love this stuff. I mean, once they know it's possible, doesn't break laws of physics, doesn't break the laws of materials, they just want to do it. I mean, sign them on. So eventually it could happen on the moon. And the reason to do it on the moon, which doesn't seem like a great place to go, is that it's the great staging place for a space activity. If you can go to the moon with a base, you can mine the soil there for oxygen, which you could breathe or turn into rocket fuel. There's water in the lunar soil. So you can survive on the moon. And then if you build a space elevator, you can get essentially anywhere in the solar system for the cost of almost no rocket fuel.
So I'm still trying to envision what the idea behind this is. So you have this like incredibly long cable hanging down from the moon. And how does the rocket or the whatever get lifted onto the moon?
So it's not a rocket. So just imagine you're holding a cable or a rope, a finite length piece of rope, and you're just spinning. You're just spinning it around, and it'll go straight out away from you by the centrifugal force. Well, the moon and the Earth are spinning too. So if you have a cable going into the air sufficiently high, then it will be suspended by the force caused by the spinning object that you're standing on. And it will just appear to go straight up into the air, right out into space, and hover there. It's perfectly balanced. And so then you don't need a rocket. You just make this cable robust enough that you can attach elevator cars to it, going up and down, just carrying things up and down.
So do you think this is one of the things more likely to actually happen in the future?
Well, it's a 20 to 30 year time frame. The fact that it can be done with present technology doesn't mean that it's easy. I've seen estimates of $10 to $20 billion for the cost of a space elevator. That's a lot of money, but if a set of corporations or governments got together to combine on it, it could possibly liberate an economic activity that dwarfed that number.
What is one of the more exciting developments in space travel or space life that you expect to see in your lifetime?
I think the interesting and exciting thing will be when we get a community that's living off Earth for the first time to see how they evolve. If they can get beyond the sheer hardship of it, the difficulty of being so far from the Earth, of being in close quarters, then at some point, after maybe only a couple of generations, these people will become an offshoot of the human tree. They will probably evolve into something else. They'll evolve physiologically quite quickly, because if the gravity is less, as it would be on Mars or the Moon, they will change. Their physical bodies will change even while they're alive, and if they have children and then grandchildren, they will change even more. And then psychologically, they will start to feel like a new colony, a new people. As we moved around the planet and did so for reasons of just sheer exploration or freedom or wanting open spaces, people diversified. They became quite different. And so the first off-Earth humans that live there and die there and then have children and grandchildren, they're going to quite quickly turn into maybe even a new species.
Among the things you've done, I mean, you were a professor at the University of Arizona in Tucson, but you've also taught in a special program that teach astronomy, cosmology to Tibetan monks in exile in the Himalayas in India. And it's a special program called Science for Monks Leadership Program. And it was actually organized by the Dalai Lama, who wrote the introduction to one of your earlier books, which is called Humble Before the Void. And this book is all about you teaching science to these Tibetan monks. And in the introduction, the Dalai Lama writes, "My own interest in science began when I was a young boy growing up in Tibet and came to understand the importance of science as another approach to understanding reality." What did the Dalai Lama tell you about why he thought it was important to teach science to Tibetan monks?
And I've only met him once, but the message he has for his own cohort of monastics is that he doesn't want his culture to become a museum piece. You know, without a homeland, their culture is sort of eroding or being destroyed. And the monastic tradition is venerable, but it really hasn't changed for centuries. And he wants his monks and nuns to be trained for the 21st century, and so he wanted to inject math and science into the curriculum. And he's famously said that when he was four and picked to be the 14th reincarnation of the Bodhisattva of Compassion, if that hadn't happened, he'd have been an engineer. So he thinks very analytically, he thinks very logically, he's very engaged with talking to scientists, and he wanted that to become part of what monks learn, to be in the 21st century, to not be isolated culturally. And it's a wonderful program. I enjoy going there pretty much every year.
But on the other hand, the whole point of being monastic in some ways is that you are isolated.
Yes, it gives them an amazing separation with which to approach these sort of ineffable questions of our existence and origin and dark matter and dark energy. So when they engage the topics of cosmology, even though their math and physics training is slight, they ask the most fundamental questions. They're brilliant students because they're completely committed to learning. They're totally engaged. They're indefatigable. And they ask these incredible questions.
Give us an example of an incredible question.
Well, sometimes as an instructor, you even get frustrated by incredible questions because they bring you to a halt. So we were talking one time about how astronomers measure the age of the universe to be 13.8 billion years. And also about the Big Bang and so on. And one of them just put his hand up almost sheepishly and asked, "Well, you measure time with radioactive decay and so on. How does time have any meaning before there were atoms? Or how do you measure time itself? Or what is the meaning of time?" You know, so they just unravel to the most profound question that will floor most physicists.
And how do you come back to a question like that? What do you say?
Well, it, of course, derails my entire lesson plan because we end up in a big discussion about the nature of time, which, you know, philosophers and physicists still wrestle with. Is time an emergent property, you know, that doesn't have any underlying reality? Is time a function of the way the universe is, such that if the universe were slightly different, time as we understand it wouldn't exist? We essentially spin off into these metaphysical and philosophical discussions.
What was the monk's understanding of stars and the planets when you began teaching?
So they do have a quite archaic view of cosmology. Their historical cosmology in the Buddhist tradition, which is inherited from Hinduism, involves Mount Meru at the center of the universe. It's sort of a, you know, very much a pre-Copernican, earth-centered, almost flat earth view. And the stars and the distances to the stars don't have any real meaning to them. However, Buddhism and Hinduism are rich traditions, and the Dalai Lama's noted that there are 15 or 16 different cosmologies in their tradition. And he just laughs and says, well, 12 of them are just silly and wrong. So, you know, the monks are allowed and encouraged to be selective in which part of their tradition they accept. And some parts of their tradition are strikingly concordant with modern cosmology. They have parts of their tradition that talk about deep time, cycles of time of billions or even trillions of years. They have parts of their tradition that accommodate the idea of infinite worlds with life on them. You know, so they are fully capable of taking the vastness of time and space that we understand in modern cosmology, and it's assimilating it because it's part of their tradition too.
What was the monk's reaction to the Big Bang theory, the idea that this enormous explosion is the start of, you know, of our planet and the start of life? And how does that compare with the belief that they had before you started teaching them about science?
So the Big Bang itself is probably one area of cosmology that, that doesn't sit naturally in the Buddhist tradition, because they believe in endless time, in cycles of time, and, you know, space that might come into being and then go out of existence, and life that does the same. However, cosmology is sort of moving in their direction, because astronomers, having now diagnosed the Big Bang back to the first tiny fractions of a second, have started asking their own profound questions, such as, you know, is the Big Bang the only space-time we can talk about, or what caused the Big Bang, or what was the precursor state? And out of those speculations, they've come up with ideas that if the universe, say, was a quantum fluctuation, there might have been other quantum fluctuations, and so perhaps there's a multiverse concept. And time is endless, where the origination of our space and time in the Big Bang is just one event. And that's starting to sound similar to the Buddhist tradition.
Chris Impey, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much. And safe travels back to India in October.
Thanks, Terry. I've enjoyed it.
Chris Impey spoke with Terry last Monday. Impey is the author of the new book, Beyond, Our Future in Space. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Saman, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.